The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
So as we think through where we are in the Reformation process, we've looked at the backdrop of the Reformation, the influences, the life of Luther, the explosion that took three directions. We've called it the magisterial, the radical, and the counter-reformation. Remember that the magisterial Reformation divided into three streams. We considered them as the Lutheran, the Reformed, and the Elizabethan or Anglican. We've looked at the Radical Reformation, and we noted how it also divided into three substantial streams. We spoke of the Anabaptist, the Spiritualist, and then thirdly, the Anti-Trinitarian or the Rationalist branch. Now we come to the Reformation of the Catholic Church on its own terms, the Counter-Reformation, a Reformation that is attempting to address the Protestant explosion. Indeed, it was an explosion. It had all these different movements and ideas that were coming at once, and the very traditional Catholic Church had to do something. Obviously, there was an attempt to stop Luther, but it was far broader than that. And the reality was the Catholic tradition had to admit that it had problems. Erasmus, you'll recall, as a forerunner of the Reformation, was one who was kept within the Church's bosom safely throughout his life, and his whole purpose was reform. Reform by education. And his notion of ad fontes, back to the fountains, the original sources, was a profoundly important reformational movement and admitted the fact that we have a crisis in our church. We do need to reform. The problem was the reform was proposed in a way that the Catholic Church could not accept. It's hard to reform and accept and continue if you're being called the Antichrist. I mean, that's basically saying we should go out of business. That's the only reformation that's possible. So how could there be a conservative reformation? Admitting we have problems, there were things that were caused. It's not all our fault. It's mainly Luther's fault, but we do have some issues we have to address. And so we find as we look at our material for today, some of the main streams of the Counter-Reformation. First of all, the monastic orders needed to be addressed. Secondly, the development of the general council. This was an issue of conciliarism that had worked in the medieval period that's being readdressed. So let's look at those first two items in our first lecture today. Yes, question? Anybody? The Counter-Reformation notes, where are they at? Okay, some didn't get them in the middle. Let's make sure we got those. Okay. The reform of the, or renewal of the monastic orders is a key thing. Now let's go back and reconsider for a moment what we know about the monastic communities. They were those that had developed in what we called the Benedictine era, the very early period of the medieval time, when suddenly it was here that there was a particularly exciting opportunity of change and growth. But it was a retreat from the action of the world. They became conventicles that were isolated, and therefore what was developing there was enriching, but it was not culturally developing. They retreated from the civilization at large. Feudalism was basically the word of the day. You were either a lord or you were a serf. And if you were an educated middle-class person, you were in a monastery, and by and large that meant you had little intercourse with the society at large. As these communities developed, they had several forces weighing in against them. One was their succession of wisdom, property, of ideas caused them to prosper. And we all know, as sad as it is, when prosperity comes, it's very difficult to maintain one's discipline and purity. The Lord says in the law of Deuteronomy, do not forget your God when you come into homes you did not build and you harvest from trees you did not plant. Be aware that you say, it was my wisdom or my hands that did these things for me. Remember, I, the Lord God, give you wealth that my covenant might be established. But unfortunately, the history of the church is that when blessings come, we tend to end up losing the spiritual vitality. Actually, there's a story that's told. I don't know if this is true from Erasmus. I've heard it attributed to him since we mentioned him, that the church was showing its display of its treasures to a visiting group of people from another country in some particular German cathedral. And The person that was showing the tour said, well, no longer do we need say, silver and gold have we none, because there are all these treasures. And so the response was someone walking along, but nor can we say, take up your bed and walk anymore. You know, the point is, we have the treasures, but what about the spiritual power? Well, the church in the monastic orders had begun to accumulate great treasures. It's truly an anomaly. Poverty was the vow, but they had begun to accumulate huge wealth, building vast communities of beauty of all sorts. They had nothing, but they had everything. So fascinating Christian communities. And it created a certain amount of hostility and anger, obviously, when all this wealth was kept inside. It also created a certain amount of natural corruption. With opulence, there comes often a tendency to set aside moral standards. And so we noted the concubinage issue. There are stories of some of the popes and bishops sneaking in women into their cloistered communities in large chests so that they would not be seen. These things actually did go on. It's fascinating that Machiavelli, when he was writing his work, The Prince, trying to figure out who was the one who really knew how to practice politics in its most bloodthirsty form, he looked to the Borgia popes and said, here are the ones that know how to do what I'm talking about. So the corruption is all over the place. And so how does the monastic order renew itself? Well, it can go back to its original primary tenets and try to reclaim what's been lost. And that did happen. There are attempts to go back to the fundamental ideas of poverty, celibacy, and obedience. One of the things that does develop among the priesthood as a counter-reformational act is the required confessional was now required to have a confessional box with a screen in the middle so that there would not be any opportunity for any physical contact in the time of the confessing. Because you remember what a temptation it was. Think about this. If you were a priest, maybe a monastic priest, or maybe a secular priest, and you had the total power of forgiveness, and you were celibate, and you had taken a vow of celibacy, and yet you were not able to keep it very well. And here is this temptation that was created, that you're required to see a person who's called to confess all of their sins openly and explicitly. And think of the opportunity that created. Well, those opportunities for sinfulness, well, if the priest sinned, he could forgive himself because he had the power of forgiveness. It created an immunity and a temptation. The means and the mode and the opportunity were all woven together. The Counter-Reformation introduced the confessional box with the screen in the middle to say, we have to admit, we've had some problems here. Okay, and so that's part of what happened. And as a result of reforming, there were other movements that came on the scene. Obviously, throughout church history, when something happens, there's a cause. There's a need for it. And that movement begins, and it can become a correcting movement, and it may begin to lose its way. And so as a reaction, another movement to reform will come along. And that happens in this reformational time with a series now of new orders that will come into being. The classic Augustinian order continues on and will wrestle with how will we purify ourselves, and we'll talk about the theological issues, etc. But a whole series of new orders come into being, and I list them here for you. And let's talk about each of them very quickly. First of all, they're the Capuchins. And this was an attempt to recover St. Francis. St. Francis of Assisi was the one who developed the strictest form of poverty and the idea of giving up everything for the good of the poor. There was an attempt to reform the Franciscan order by starting one that outdid St. Francis. And in 1528, it comes into being. So you can see this is right in the Reformation era. What was one of the reformational complaints? All that Rome cares about is gold. Indulgences, building their buildings, taking money from the poor instead of caring for the poor and advancing the gospel. So what do the Capuchins do? They emphasize charity, giving away the church's treasures for the needy and proclaiming the gospel from a Roman Catholic perspective. In other words, that was an admission that we have cared too much for money. We have not cared enough for preaching. And so the Capuchins come into being. By the way, I understand there is a connection between Cappuccino and the Capuchins. Now, if you like cappuccino there, so you can try to remember a little church history. My understanding is that the white froth on the top reminded someone of the white cowl of the Capuchin order. Now, I'm not sure if that's where the story comes from, but apparently there's at least some kind of linguistic link. I don't think they discovered this wonderful beverage, as far as I know. I don't think coffee had been introduced yet into Europe at this time. I may be wrong, but I don't think so. Another movement were the Theatines, 1524, just a few years before the Capuchins. And they come from Tiana, from which it gets Theatine. I think it's named for its region of coming into being. And their focus was anti-heresy, especially in Italy. And their two means was preaching. Now, isn't that interesting? Luther's great emphasis, we need to preach the word. So this now becomes a preaching order. We need to preach. A development of not just the mass where people come in and get what they need and leave, not just sacramental life, but the proclamation of God's word in some way. And they coupled their preaching at the heresies of the day, which would include, obviously, the Reformed and Lutheran and Anabaptist and other Protestant varieties of messages. In Italy, they came into being, and of course, Italy never developed any Protestant movement of any significance. The few Protestants that came into being typically had to flee. But they also used the Inquisition, the whole process of putting physical coercion over against those that would suggest a different way than the established church. We have another order that I know very little bit about. I don't know that some of these do not have much of a significance, but you see there the Somashi, 1532, just another order that I've come across and know almost nothing about them. But again, you see Reformation. We need to reform our greatest strength, which was a monastic order. It was what brought the strength to Europe of the Catholic tradition. We have another group called the Barnabites in 1533. This take comes into being in Italy and Milan. Their focus, that should say, missions and education. And they get the name because they were given the Church of St. Barnabas in Milan. And so their focus was, we need to get our message out. We have been too complacent here at home. And we have to remember, if you studied late ancient church and early medieval, there was a tremendous missionary movement in the Roman Catholic tradition. There's now a new impetus. We have something to say, and we've got to get out and get the message out. So Roman Catholic missions will become very dramatically strong as a result of the Counter-Reformation. There is a renewal going back to the basics. And going back to the basics is, why does the church exist? It has a message to tell. So they start preaching the Catholic message at home, and they say, well, we should preach it again to the nation. So the missionary orders begin to strengthen. We'll talk a little bit about the Jesuits in a moment. Another significant movement are the Ursulines. 1535. Again, you can see this is now right in the clear Protestant era. The Augsburg Confession has come into being. There's a concern now. Why? Because women are being told it's all right to marry. Marriage is good. That's what the Protestant movement said. It said it's even all right for nuns to leave their nunneries and marry preachers, priests, that marriage is good. Well, how are you going to react to that? It's by a renewed emphasis on the spiritual calling of women to the unique vows that they should have as the leaders in the church in their special arena as virgins married to Christ. And so the Ursuline order emphasized reclaiming women, not saying to women, marriage is your goal in life, it's good. No, a higher calling for you is to go into the monastic community for women. And so they emphasized education. And so you notice here the idea that they took the threefold vow of the monastic order of poverty, celibacy, and obedience, which was part of the women's orders as well, and they added a fourth, and that was education. They began very strongly the education of women, and they said education is something that we must do. And to this day, the Ursuline order exists, and they have a strength in educating women wherever they go. So feminine education. So you can see these are ideas that have been gleaned or are reacting to the reformational movement. We must say, is everyone allowed to read? That's what Luther said. Well, we better be educating women. Should women be leaving the monastic life? No, they should be coming into it. And they emphasized then the strict enclosure, the cloistering, that they were to have no involvement with the outside world, but they would draw the young women in and have a community of education and life that would give them service in the church. Another group, the Oratorians, founded by Philip Neri, 1575. So this would be now late reformational period. They emphasized again the classic vows of the order, and what's significant about the Oratorians is that they focused profoundly on music. You've heard the word oratorio? Well, they've actually given their order's name to that kind of music, a special sort of music for worship. They were a social and socially conscious and artistic movement that emphasized not just strict devotional exercises, but also the power of bringing music to life in various ways. So you can see the Palestrina means a little oratory. And they were given to their strict vows and bringing music and worship and cultural expression. It might be argued that the Reformation, with its focus on the singing of the Psalms, Luther's focus on hymnody, helped to create a Roman Catholic response that we should have a creation of great church music. But of all of the orders, the most dramatic and the most powerful in terms of the Counter-Reformation will be the work of the Jesuits, the movement of the Society of Jesus, the SJ, you'll see after author's name sometimes. And the Jesuits will come into being as a result of a papal affirmation in 1540. We could call these the Marines of the Counter-Reformation. They're the people that are going to hit the beach and take back enemy territory. The Jesuits, perhaps more than any other order, will go into Eastern Europe and take back Poland. And they will begin the whole process of trying to say, stop the Reformation. And they enter into Hungary and take back much of Hungary that had gone to the Protestant Reformation. So Eastern Europe is reclaimed in a dramatic way by the Counter-Reformation. And the Jesuits are very strong. Now, one of the things in terms of pastoral theology I'd like to suggest for you to think about, when you go into your full-time ministry, some of you are in full-time ministry, I'm aware, but as you go forward into ministry, one of the things that will be always tempting you is, I just don't have time to get out and visit people in the hospital, and I'll tell you why. You say, I got to drive 40 minutes to get there. I get there and I see the person for 2 minutes, and they're not sure if they really remembered I was there or not, and then I got to leave. And you say, boy, I can't waste 2 hours. You ever say that? For you, that'll be the kind of thinking. By the way, I will tell you this. People almost never have forgotten the fact I visited them in the hospital. They've forgotten hundreds of my sermons through the years. Do you know that? I've maybe taught them something, but they can't possibly, but they'll say, I remember, and you were there. That's uncanny. Even though they're anesthetized, they'll remember somehow you visited, and they'll never forget it. So the reaching out to people is critical. But there's another reason, not only the impact, but when a person is in a state of illness, this is a time of incredible spiritual reflection. People are remembering their mortality. They're remembering, what does life really matter? What if I die right now? What has life been about? It's a very strategic time. And in the reformational setting, there are two great stories about this. One is Heinrich Bullinger wrote his second Helvetic Confession in a time of very severe illness, thinking he was dying. He was confessing his faith. And that confession lives to this day. That came out of that time of his agony, where he just said, this is what I believe, confessing his faith. Similarly, Ignatius Loyola was someone who was profoundly ill. I think he actually was injured in a battle, if I'm not mistaken. He was wounded, and he nearly died with the infection and other things that were going on. And as he was wrestling with what is the meaning of his life, and as he agonized in his very slow recovery, he determined that if he survived, he would give his life for the service of God, by absolute obedience to the Pope, yes. So he realized his ability to fight was utterly ruined because of the inability for his leg to heal. So you're going to meet people like that too, say, who am I now? What good am I now that I've gone through this illness? Well, out of that reappraisal of his life, he said, I'm going to give myself to God. And he started a movement that still exists today and is probably the single most important force out of the Counter-Reformation intellectually that stopped the Reformation's advance. And it was built upon absolute obedience to the Pope's wishes. Now, he developed a very strict piety, and the Jesuits, following Ignatius Loyola, have a devotional book that he wrote that's called, I think, Spiritual Exercises. And his concept was to take his militaristic training, and as they trained people strictly in military order and conduct, in absolute obedience in the chain of command, this was his concept to be brought into the order, that you didn't ask questions, you didn't reason anything, you just did what you were told to do with the commitment of a soldier going into combat. And he created a spiritual army. And the Jesuits emphasized scholarship, the highest level of learning, and absolute obedience to commands. And they become then the force that will take the Counter-Reformation's renewed focus on Catholic heritage and tradition throughout Europe and ultimately throughout the world. It's fascinating that the Jesuits will become the first real, if I'm not mistaken, missionaries that will make it to Japan. And for a period of maybe 50 years, they will bring a tremendous spiritual impact on Japan until there's a huge counter-reaction to them that will end up having many of the Japanese Christians literally crucified to destroy the movement. They were Jesuits there. And Christianity was shut out for centuries thereafter. But the Jesuits were profound missionaries, and they will also come to America with the discovery of the New World. They will be very important in planning the missionary movements in the South and Western United States, the missions and things. Many of those will have Jesuit roots. And there, South America will have Jesuits bringing the word of this faith to them. So this movement is extremely important. The name of the founders, Ignatius Loyola, perhaps the most important missionary is Francis Xavier. You can see his dates there, and he 1506 to 32. And he was a missionary to East Indies, Japan, and according to the tradition, thousands were baptized in India. So it was a huge movement of missionary work. The goals, help the poor, especially the education of the boys and evangelization of the heathen. The education of the boys continues to this day. You'll find the finest Roman Catholic scholars are typically out of the Jesuit order because they've gone to their schools. And they try to find the brightest and young children in the Catholic tradition and send them to their schools as developing an elite of highly educated young men. So that movement still exists to this day. Now, they've waned a little bit in their full loyalty to the Pope. They have become, in modern times, a little more of the counter-criticism of the papacy. And so they have not maintained that fully, but at this time, that was a very important part. Some of the leading names of the theologians there you see are, mainly you should know the name Robert Bellarmine. He wrote substantially against the Protestant movement, and many of the reformers had to interact with his critique of Protestant theology. Now, as we think about these movements, they were trying to clean up the struggles that were evident to the Protestants, that the Protestants were able to ridicule and capitalize upon in various ways. And they did it by, in essence, admitting we have to straighten up some of these things. And these orders did it. And by these orders taking these leads, the other more classical monastic orders began to follow their pattern as well and say we must go back to higher standards. We must recommit ourselves to our vows. We must focus on our calling and our purpose. So there's nothing like competition that brings out the best in someone that wants to exist. And the competition from Protestantism brought out these new movements and the purification in terms of their historic calling of many of the classic monastic orders. So the older ones tried to renew. The newer ones came in and brought renewal and carried on. So there's a new birth of monastic orders. But the most important reformational effort came through the Pope's attempt to utilize the council. Now, we've told this story before, but let's remember that at the end of the medieval period, a church council was something that had been used effectively to purify the church when there were three popes at once. The second time in church history, there were three popes all excommunicating the other, and they had to solve the problem. So the councils of the church brought order. Well, once the papacy had reestablished control, they couldn't criticize conciliarism, but they needed to control it because that would compromise the authority of the pope. So the decision was made only a pope can call a future council. And you'll remember that when Luther writes his classic work and his appeal to the nobility to do the Reformation, he says, you guys have got to do it because the papacy has insulated itself from Reformation. They alone can call a council to reform the church, and if the pope doesn't want to get reformed, it's not going to happen. So you've got to help. Okay, so this is the beginning of the magisterial Reformation. The magistrate has to do what the pope won't. The problem was, by Luther's appeal to the church to have a reformation and the magistrate to have a reformation, he was compelled to have to say, we need to have a council. By saying that, automatically he was identifying himself in a position of rebellion to the pope's position, who said, I alone can call a council. And that meant that he was branded as a heretic. Eck finds Luther as a heretic. Well, eventually, since they could not squelch Luther because of the protection of his king, Frederick the Wise, who kept him safe in this time, eventually a council became a necessity. They had to yield. They had to solve the Protestant problem. And so what they did is that they began to stack the deck in their favor, and that's out of which will come the Council of Trent. All right, you wanted a council. We've given you a council. And no Protestant would dare go because they knew there was no possibility of ever being heard. They said, it's useless. There's no way we'll be heard. But you see the great ability to say, you've been pleading for counsel, we've finally given you counsel, and you are just intransigent in your rebellion. You won't even participate. You guys really are protesters. That's all you're good for, is splintering the church. We wanted you to come, and you wouldn't come. Well, the political advantage of that was quite powerful, because the Catholic tradition was able to say, we asked the Protestants to sit down at the table with us and talk, and they wouldn't show up. But here's what we did decide at the council they themselves asked for. We've wrestled with all the problems. We've wrestled with all of their proposals, all of their theology. And we went line by line and considered their issues, and we've made conclusions. And the conclusions then are developed in the canons of the Council of Trent. Okay, the Council of Trent will be held over a period of time from 1545 to 1563. It did not meet without breaks. It had periods where it would meet and then stop and continue. Now, the closest that there ever was for their bringing together the Vatican and the Protestants into a dialogue was this colloquy of Ratisbon in 1541. And you may remember I suggested that that was a most remarkable time because there was at least a momentary agreement between Lutheran, Reformed, and Catholic on the doctrine of justification. That Melanchthon represented the Protestant Lutherans, Calvin was there, and Bucer was there, and Cardinal Contarini was there, and they all agreed. And of course, Luther read the document and said it was a defiled thing because it spoke about inherent righteousness. Calvin said, isn't it remarkable how much a Catholic has yielded to us? Everything we teach is here. You may remember I suggested that shows that different approach toward the way that sanctification and justification interplay in Lutheran and Reformed theology. Here, Calvin was prepared to say that we do talk about an inherent righteousness, not that justifies us, but that accompanies justification, because the Spirit is inseparable from the imputation of righteousness. Well, Luther was worried about that linkage, and he says it destroys justification. The great step that was developed by the Roman Catholic theologians here was suggesting that this is a work of grace, that the Holy Spirit is putting this new inherent righteousness within us. It was a gracious work. And by the way, that is one of the issues that comes out in the most recent agreement between the World Lutheran Federation and the Roman Catholics when they agreed on Sola Gratia, that they were coming in some measure, I think, back to what was agreed on at Ratisbon. Okay, so not that they appealed to the document, I'm not suggesting that, but the position of saying, well, we really do teach grace alone, that they were coming close to what this early reformational agreement was all about. Now, I've heard no one make the parallel, so don't think that they quoted this document, but I think they're onto the same thing. Okay, now let's talk quickly about the Council of Trent, and we'll stop for a couple quick questions before a break. 1545 to 1563, then, will finally bring about the official council that Luther had called for, but now no Protestant would participate in. And there was the desire, therefore, to bring about Reformation. Obviously, they had to do something. They can't just let the Protestant movement take its control over the Catholic European setting. And so some of their reforms will include such things as, we want to make sure there's a seminary in every diocese. We must begin to educate our priests. Remember, up before the Reformation, many priests could not even read. So now we need to educate them in our tradition. So universal education of the priesthood is a direct result of Luther's desire to educate the peasant. See the point? He wanted education so that any plowboy could read the Bible and criticize the Pope. Well, he was so effective in bringing about that desire of universal education that now he even forced the Roman Catholics to educate their priests. So he was effective. Now, he didn't get them educated in the Bible he wanted them, but he was right. Education was needed, and they admitted that. And they required now that a seminary would be in every diocese to train students and ultimately the priests for ministry. We've already mentioned the establishment of the confessional. That is, confession was required, but now the desire to maintain a clear protection between any sexual violations between the priest and the parishioner, the confessional is put in place, required. And probably the most important thing to understand, when you think of the Council of Trent, you should think of the word anathema, because they anathematize almost everything that's Protestant. They will go down line by line, issue by issue, the Protestant cause and faith as it was understood at that time, and they will say, let him be anathema who teaches. And you remember, that's a good biblical word. Paul will use that in Galatians 1. It says, if anyone preaches any other gospel than we have preached, let him be anathema. Even if an angel from heaven were to preach it, let him be anathema. He said, let him go to hell. Strong language. Let him be condemned. Let him be lost. The point is that theology was important. And the tragic issue is that the Roman Catholic Church anathematizes someone who teaches the theology that Paul wrote to the Roman Church in his great epistle. That is justification by faith alone. That great truth that God justifies the ungodly by faith. It says, anyone who holds this, let him be anathema. Now, if you're ever looking for any proof that at least historically that the Roman Catholic Church had become, quote, the whore of Babylon, you know, from the apocalyptic language of John, and then picked up by the reformers and held and maintained, it was at this point where they would take the essence of the gospel and anathematize it. It's almost as if they turned Paul's Galatians epistle in chapter 1 on its head. where he said, if you preach any other gospel than this, which is by faith alone, let him be anathema. They turned around and said, if you teach faith alone, be anathema. They were in direct violation with the scriptures, and it's so patent you can't miss it. And so the Roman Catholic Church officially, at this point, destroyed the doctrine that is essential to the gospel. They said, it is not by faith alone, and if you teach that, you are to be condemned. Now, that raises a lot of interesting questions, and we're going to spend some time talking about ecumenics and the newer movements in Protestantism, and we'll take that on later this afternoon. Yes? Okay, well, the question that you're raising, I actually want to spend our last hour today talking about. So we'll really wrestle with the questions of what does Trent mean today? I think that's one of the things we need to, if the Reformation has any significance, we've got to ask the question, what does Trent mean? But let me answer your question this way. In its day, Trent met three times over 15 or 20 years, and the Pope was intimately involved at every point. And when it was determined with consciousness and commitment, and that meant that classical Roman Catholicism was here born. So what I want you to know is that what Roman Catholicism was in its anti-Protestant spirit, which is something we have not lived with in our country, in America, and especially in post-Vatican II, there's a whole new face to these things, and we need to talk about what's going on. But what you do need to realize that in that day, that was the spirit that would say, persecute Protestants because they are teaching a false gospel. And it was not missed. It was worldwide. Wherever Protestantism went, there was an attempt to destroy it by the Roman Catholic movement because it was heretical. And there was no mistake about it. The Roman Catholic Church said, we are the true church. Outside the church, there is no salvation. You're a Protestant, you're outside the church. You're lost. You're perishing, and don't forget about it. We'll tell you right up front, you're going to hell because you're a Protestant. That was the Roman Catholic position from the Council of Trent until at least the early 1900s, and even later, because the Vatican II is really the 1950s is when you get to that. So the change has been profound through the impact of modernity on the Catholic Church. And I'll talk about that later, but I do want you to understand what Catholicism was at its most rugged anti-Protestant form, it's directly as a result of Trent. Okay? That kind of Catholicism we don't encounter today in America. We don't know about it. But you read back in the history where Catholics and Protestants literally were constantly fighting each other. It's because of Trent. What's that? Okay. Well, then you have an example of the continuing spirit of Trent living on in spite of the ecumenical spirit. And we'll want to talk more about that. We can't do it now because we don't have time, but I'll come back. That was part of my plan for today. Okay, another question? Not at all. In fact, we know that in the Vatican II documents, the Council of Trent is appealed to about five or six times, and every time it mentions it, it says, in no way are we lessening or changing the verdict of our council. In fact, you see, with the Vatican I Council, which is the late 1800s. I think this is when the Assumption of Mary became a dogma. One of the things it also established was the infallibility of the Pope. And since the Pope had put his imprimatur upon the Council of Trent, that means then that now forever, that has to be viewed as an infallible document. You see, they had been willing to say, well, maybe councils can get a little misguided, but they wanted to teach the indefectibility of the Church. The Church will never be able to move away from truth. It will always be preserved, and especially in its councils, and then finally in its popes. And the popes have said the Council of Trent is the word of God for this church. And so now we've got a crisis. How can we move away from it if it's infallible in character? I would say the whole thought that I would give you is, to what extent can we make an agreement with people who are in a tradition who may not hold to their tradition, but yet are part of it? That's one issue. Secondly, to what extent are people who are in their movement reforming and are consciously opposed to it, but continue in that stream? That's another. And then what do we do with the postmodern hermeneutic that allows all sorts of contradictions to stand simultaneously? So I'm going to talk about those very things when we come back. Our bell's just rung. But I want us to feel the Counter-Reformation and where we're living today, because this is where the Reformation still lives. It's right here in the Counter-Reformation and the evangelicals and Catholics together, and the recent World Lutheran Federation agreement with the Pope. So we want to talk about that, and we'll come back. Okay?